Come Again is my 30-episode audio series that addresses the biological, hormonal, and medical issues that can sabotage your sex life. This solution-driven, science-based series will help get libido to kick in and clitoral nerve endings to wake up. Come Again comes with loads of supplementary material and is intended for both healthcare professionals and the general public. Go to drstreicher.com/comeagain for more information. The Intimate Animal explores the mysteries of how we navigate our love lives, including why we're wired for social monogamy, but not necessarily sexual monogamy, why love is a literal addiction, and why intimacy is the key to human flourishing. This new book explores why we love who we love. Why do we stay in unfulfilling relationships and stray from rewarding ones? Is it ever a good idea to open a relationship? How has the digital age affected courtship? And why do some longtime couples crash and burn while others stay madly in love? In this episode, I have a conversation with the author of The Intimate Animal, Dr. Justin Garcia. I'm Dr. Lauren Stryker, a gynecologist, best-selling author, and a nationally recognized menopause expert. When it comes to menopause, midlife, and what comes after, I'm betting you've not gotten a lot of information from your own doctor. If women are given good information, they'll make good choices. And I'm here to give you the inside information. My husband and I often host musicians, thought leaders, and sometimes even politicians in our home. But our favorite is when we gather our friends to hear directly from an author about their book. A few weeks ago, I hosted a book release party with my friend Christy Hefner so our friends could meet Dr. Justin Garcia, the executive director of the Kinsey Institute, an evolutionary biologist, and one of the world's authorities on the science of sex and relationships. He also happens to be the chief scientific advisor for Match.com. Check the program notes for an episode I did a while back on that topic. So what you will hear is an introduction from Christy Hefner, a conversation with me and Justin, followed by a Q&A from the audience. And you might recognize some familiar voices, such as Dr. Pauline Mackey, Dr. Alexandra Solomon, and Bella Gandhi. So welcome to my living room for an intimate conversation with the author of The Intimate Animal.
Ladies and gentlemen, Christy Hefner.
It's my pleasure to welcome everybody on behalf of Lauren and Jason and myself to Lauren and Jason's spectacularly beautiful apartment. But perhaps even more importantly than the setting is the content. And you're in for a treat. Hey, Mary, come on in. You're in for a real treat because both Lauren and I are advisors to the Kinsey Institute. So we have worked closely with Justin over a number of years now. And we also consider him a very good friend. So first, let me introduce Justin, who is an evolutionary biologist, a sexologist, and the 8th executive director of the Kinsey Institute, and the youngest executive director of the Kinsey Institute.
Yeah. I'm aging. I used to have more hair.
And Kinsey, as many of you know, is sort of the preeminent repository of research on sexuality and over 75 years old, headquartered at the University of Indiana in Bloomington, which presents its own challenges, as you might imagine. But under Justin's leadership, the original sort of mission of Dr. Kinsey, which was really to study all the diversity of sexual behaviors, has expanded to include the interconnectedness between sexuality and relationships. And a lot of the research that's going on is captured by the book and by Justin's insatiable intellectual curiosity for what other research is going on. So you're going to find, because you will buy this book or you won't leave the apartment, that it's a fascinating exploration of the deep drive and desire for intimacy, which is not the same thing as our sex drives. And in fact, part of what is explored in the book is what is the difference between why we want whom we want, why we stray or why we stay, and what is it that we're searching for that is around intimacy and love. Lauren is going to have a conversation with Justin and then open it up to a bigger conversation because many of you in this room are knowledgeable, interested, interesting, and we'd love to make it a group conversation. But I think everyone knows Lauren, but she is a professor of obstetrics and gynecology at Northwestern. She was the founder of the Women's Sexual Health and Menopause Clinic at Northwestern. Lauren herself is an author. I have done book parties for Lauren. Mm-hmm. She's had 4 best-selling books. She's writing a 5th best-selling book. So it's a great treat to welcome Justin and his wife, Michelle Liu, here to Chicago, back to Chicago, and a great treat to have the two of them here. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to Lauren and Justin.
Thank you.
Before I start, I have to thank you, Christy, because if not for you, I would not know Justin. Christy called me up one day and said, you know, there's this really interesting board that I think you might enjoy being on, and it does require going out to Bloomington, Indiana. And I thought, oh, but this sounds pretty good. And I have to say that did it open up a whole world for me in terms of meeting Justin and all the other amazing researchers at Kinsey. And I'm so excited about this book. And we have lots of conversations on our own. Mm-hmm. And I'm glad that all of you are going to be part of this conversation. So the plan here is I think, I don't know, we'll talk about 20 minutes or so. I mean, I have enough questions for 4 hours. And then we'll open it up for all of you. All right. In my world, intimacy is a euphemism for sex, especially if someone's selling a product, as in, use this lubricant for intimacy. And I'm thinking, really? Really? But you know, a lot of that's so that you get past paywalls and you don't end up in people's junk folders. But the truth of the matter is that right now in our society, intimacy and sex are used interchangeably. And they're not. It's not the same thing. I think pretty much everyone in this room would have no trouble defining what sex is. But I'm going to have you tell us from the point of view of an evolutionary biologist, what intimacy is.
Sure. Thanks, everyone. Thank you, Christy and Lauren. And great thanks for all of you for coming out. We have so much to talk about tonight.
So we do.
It's funny you say that, Lauren. Early in my career, I was writing a grant proposal for the National Institute of Health. And I had all this stuff about sexual behavior. And it was actually in breast cancer survivors and couples, and how they were navigating their sex life after cancer diagnosis. And I got feedback from a group of colleagues, and they said, well, you know, you use the word sex too much in the proposal. Just swap it out for intimacy in the title, in the abstract, and then eventually in the grant. And I thought, this is crazy. Like, these words mean something. These words have... So that's where I really started to think more about what is this term and how are we using it. So for me, when I think about, and we could talk about what does sex mean. Actually, my colleague of mine did a famous paper on this.
It's not as straightforward as we would all believe, but I thought we'd just skip right to intimacy.
Yeah, yeah. And so for intimacy, for me, so by training, I'm an anthropologist and biologist, and I'm interested in what is the fabric of social connection? What is our species desire? What does our species require for how we connect to others? Sometimes we talk about the need to belong as a technical term. And that means that we want to feel part of something. So intimacy for me is this sense of being seen and heard and connected. That it's not, now sex is a big part of that, and part of what I try to look at here is how does sex play a part in that? But it's beyond just, what does connection mean? Connection's a sort of its own complicated term. Many of us have 1,000, 2,000, some of you, I'm looking at one of you, 50,000 connections on, or actually 250,000, excuse me, right? We have connections. We have connections, but is there an intimate relationship there? So it's not just that we are connected in some way, but a depth of that connection, that you feel seen and heard and understood. And that's a two-way street. That was sort of the essence of what I was looking at with intimacy.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. All right. So you make the case that the need for intimacy, even more than sex drive, mm-hmm. is the key to our species' survival. Mm-hmm. That's a big statement. And I have to tell you also, it is the opposite of when I teach medical students. What I tell them is there's one reason and one reason only to have sex, and that's to reproduce. Mm-hmm. And when we are no longer capable of reproducing, there's no point in having sex. Mm-hmm. From an evolutionary point of view, and that's why everyone's libido goes in the toilet after menopause and they have all these problems, because there's no need from an evolutionary point of view. But then you say, no, the need to have sex is driven by intimacy, not sex. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's a big disconnect, right? Okay, so I want you to make the case that intimacy is the evolutionary drive as opposed to sex, because... Mm-hmm.
I can't figure that one
yeah,
out.
Yeah, it's not, and that's we all know that, right? Like, we all know this idea that we think of sex for the purposes of reproduction, and we take for granted sometimes that we're in a society where we can contextualize sex for pleasure, and not everyone does. I talk a little bit about an example of the Akka foragers in Central Africa, that they will engage in sex three times in a night and then take four nights off, and then three times in a night and take four times off. So it's ritualized. But it's considered work. It's arguably more pleasurable than daytime work, but it's work, and that it's work for reproduction. So in that case, is they're a polygynously married culture. When there's this great anthropology of by Barry and Bonnie Hewlett, a couple, and they interview this one man who says, "Well, I love my first wife the most, but she went through menopause, so I had to take on a new wife because I have to reproduce." So there's really this idea that there lied for me one of the interesting data points, that there was still this connection to the first wife that he was telling these secrets to, that he was relying on emotionally, but in this particular cultural context, sex had reproductive work. So to your point, that has been the way that evolutionists have tended to think of sex, as for the purposes of reproduction. But the challenge with when we look at the human animal, if we use this evolutionary frame, there's all these things that we do in our sexual and reproductive and relationship lives that don't fit neatly into that model of a sexually reproducing species that only engages in sex for reproduction. So let's go through a few of them. One, the fact that we have the capacity to have sex across our women's menstrual cycles. We take that for granted. Many species cannot do that. There are species that the vaginal opening closes when they're not in estrus. There are species, or take a laboratory rat. We do all these experiments on reproduction in a laboratory rat. What no one says is that the female laboratory rat can't arch her back. It's called lordosis, a lordotic response. It's hormonally induced. A male can try to mount them, but they can't actually mate because they can't arch their back enough, except when they're ovulating, or in that case, when they're in estrus, not ovulating. But there's all these examples in the animal kingdom that mating is very much tied to reproduction. Our examples don't follow that rule. They don't follow those patterns of what we look at in other species. We have sex across menstrual cycles. We have sex late in life. We have sex that is not particularly fecund. And what I mean by that is we are what we call a low fecundity or low fertility species. The average couple this is more in your domain. The challenge doing this with Lauren is she's going to tell me when I'm full of shit. But
that once in this book.
Yes. Thank you. I'm still doing galley proofs, and she's like, "You might want to fix this." Said, thank you very much. That's a friend. The average couple tries for 6 months to get pregnant. That's unusual for any sexually reproducing mammal. How is it that we are taking so long for reproductive patterns? But we have the capacity for sex across menstrual cycles. That, to me, that starts to come together to tell a story of what's the role of sex in our species. The role of sex in our species isn't strictly reproductive, but it's not also strictly social. There's these arguments sometimes that sex is social. Often you'll hear these arguments, like bonobos, and sex is for... The thing that everyone gets wrong about bonobos is they mostly have sex in food patches so that they don't have a fight over what they're about to eat. So it's not that they're this sort of swinging primate. So for me, there's a lot of evidence that says, okay, we're engaging in sex for reproduction, but there's this context, there's this relationship context that turns out for humans, every society anthropologists have studied for the most part, we have examples of romantic love, that sex tends to occur in long-term relationships. Reproduction tends to occur in long-term relationships. And it has all this other meaning that we attribute to it, socially, culturally, but also biologically, in terms of what are the responses that we feel with sexual activity. So my argument was that I think we've overly tethered it to reproduction. But if we can kind of expand our lens, suddenly we see a bunch of things about the way our species reproduces, the way our species engages in sex, that doesn't really fit that mold.
This is a huge relief. Seriously.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
I mean, no, this is mm-hmm. good news. Yeah. Okay, the other thing that, one of the many very interesting things in this book mm-hmm. is, a theme is that we have evolved for social monogamy, mm-hmm. but not for sexual monogamy, which creates a conflict, mm-hmm. you know, you think. So I'm going to read a passage so that everybody knows what I'm talking about here. All right, this is directly from the book. All right, crucially, however, social monogamy is not always sexual monogamy. That's the problem. So much of the misery we felt in our romantic relationships as a species, so much of the psychological torment derives from this crucial fact. Our unhappiness in love often points back to our attempts to make or keep a socially monogamous relationship sexually monogamous or vice versa. The evolution of human mating, encompassing selection for mating systems and reproductive strategies over millions of years, has given us a definitive answer about what works for the species. And the answer is social, but not necessarily sexual monogamy. So have we gotten it all wrong? I mean, from an evolutionary point of view, is long-term monogamy ridiculous? And are we all doomed to fail in our long-term monogamous relationships?
No, I don't think so. I don't think so. I don't think that's the... But it does tell us, when we think about the tensions. So what's interesting for me as a biologist who works with physicians and psychologists and anthropologists, is biologists don't talk about monogamy in the way that we do in general about human behavior and relationships. We really talk about two elements, and that's the mating system and the sexual behavior system. And that's, so we have a relationship structure that I'll call social monogamy. That's that we tend to form intense pair bonds with another person, sometimes lifelong, sometimes multiple within the experiences of our life, with serial monogamy for some people. That pair bond, that social monogamy relationship, that is, so biologists call that mutual territory defense, mutual nest building, mutual raising of offspring, the mutual part. That's where this intimacy piece comes in. This idea that you have a co-pilot, a co-CEO that you go through life with. That's the relationship structure. That's a different question for me from the behavior of sexual fidelity, of sexual exclusivity. That's sexual monogamy. So when we start to tease them apart, we can start to see the tensions that it can exist in a relationship, but also in the best case when they're aligned, the joys that can come with relationships. So I'm not a moralist in any way. Let me frame that. I'm not a moralist, well, about anything really, but I'm not a moralist
about sex anyway.
Not about our sexual lives. So about, we can think about these two pieces that I don't think one is necessarily better or worse than the other. But it identifies the tensions between a relationship structure of social monogamy, a pair bond, and then this desire for sexual novelty. And what's so interesting is that we actually have two evolutionary adaptations. We have the adaptation for the pair bond. Only 3-5% of mammals have the capacity. We take for granted that we fall in love. Only 3-5% of mammals can form these intense pair bonds. Most species don't have the architecture in their brain to fall in love, the capacity to form this intense bond. So we have this ability, 15% of primates can do it, to form pair bonds. But then there's the question of sexual fidelity. And it turns out most species who form pair bonds, they are not always sexually exclusive. And that there's a tension there. But what happens is that the pair bond tries to impose sexual exclusivity. We see over and over in the natural world this tendency to say, I use this one example of, I was in graduate school watching red-winged blackbirds in upstate New York, and a pair had been mated and one flew away in a another male came in the territory, and it's what we call extra pair copulations, what we call infidelity in humans, or what we might call an afternoon delight. And right, and so, but then the other male came back, and the two grappled. They fought each other. They fell into the reeds, and only one flew out. That's the story of Mother Nature. Red in tooth and claw is the term, the expression that biologists use. So there was this attempt to try and maintain exclusivity over the pair bond. Birds are different. About 90% of birds form pair bonds for a breeding season. So there's an attempt to form this exclusivity. But once we understand that there are different levers, that there are different levers in the brain, there's actually different neuropeptides and hormones about pair bonding and about sexual desire. Once we know that, and then we think about them as different evolutionary mechanisms, different selection mechanisms, a mechanism to form an intense bond, but also a mechanism for sexual novelty and variety, then we can start to see the tensions. Now, for some people, that means you're in a relationship and you engage in infidelity because you have a desire for sexual novelty. That comes with all sorts of challenges for most. You could be in a relationship and you open your relationship to the question you just said, right? Maybe it's that monogamy, social monogamy doesn't work. You open your relationship, then you get your sexual novelty. That works for some people. Our data says that majority it doesn't work for, but it works for some quite well. And then you could be in a relationship and you have this desire for sexual novelty. And I think to your question, Lauren, you're really important, the key question of it, what do you do about that tension? You take the desire for sexual novelty and you bring it into the primary partnership. So then you say, how do I have a primary partnership and cultivate a sense of novelty and excitement with that partner? So I don't think it necessarily has to pull you away from your primary partnership. But once we understand that there are these two levers, the power of love and then the power, the desire for variation, we can kind of understand, you know, we all walk around with those two levers and have less shame about those two levers and also have more understanding of how, when we understand it, when we can name it, then we can harness it. And maybe it's to more effectively have an affair, but it could also be to say, how do I introduce the novelty into my primary relationship?
You know, you're not a therapist, but you should be a therapist because you're really good at this. But you also know a lot about relationships because mm-hmm. what Christy didn't mention and I didn't mention, we probably should have, mm-hmm. is your relationship with Match.com and mm-hmm. your role with Match, I shouldn't say relationship, your role with Match.com mm-hmm. for how many years now?
16.
Yeah. And so Justin has been the guy who every year gets all that data from Match.com, mm-hmm. analyzes it to have some insight into what's going on with dating in America and what mm-hmm. are the trends, and that is a whole nother conversation. but in the book, you yeah. describe the holy grail of as a relationship that's both exciting and safe, mm-hmm. yet almost impossible to achieve because of the constraints of dating in a digital world, mm-hmm. something you have incredible expertise in. So my question for you, is it just technology and all this digital stuff that's made it harder to forge real connections, or is there something else going on?
Yeah, I think it's a mix. I think there's a mix of things when we think about, so if we put on this evolutionary hat, which I invite all of us to do tonight, right, and think about how we understand the animal within and our desire for social connection, for intimacy, desire for sexual novelty, part of it is technology, but the issue with technology is it's a vehicle. It's for me, for what I'm thinking about dating. So when I think about the challenges of dating apps, for instance, I'm not really convinced by this argument that dating apps are ruining our dating lives. I think that the dating apps are symptomatic of there's so much data. The bigger issue is that you can pick up your phone and find 3,000 partners before lunch. The human brain isn't used to that much information. So then we get ourselves in this sense of, well, it was a wonderful lunch I had with you, but you know, you really had to hold your fork that way. I'm sure I could find someone on here who's not gonna hold their fork. And we get in this sense of, well, I can constantly find, here's my list of 30 items, and I'm gonna find that person with 30 items, which makes sense. Any foraging model actually predicts that. You keep thinking you're gonna find what you really want. But you get in this world of constantly thinking, well, that was a nice lunch, but I know I can find someone else on that app that's not going to do what you just did. So we get in this, it's sometimes people talk about cognitive overload or the paradox of choice, that there's so much data that we have a hard time focusing because we have this sense of there's other options. So relationship scientists, for instance, will always say the grass, we have a tendency to think the grass is greener on the other side, but the grass is greener where you water it, or this idea that you focus in on the person in front of you. And then try to sort through what are the, you know, like, okay, well, you hold your fork a little funny, but maybe that's charming, right? Or I've married someone who's chopsticks. This is different, right? You learn an entirely different culture. You learn an entirely different way of thinking of what are those sort of silly things sometimes. Sometimes they're big things, but often they can be little things because we're so focused on harnessing something. But on the other part that I think is cultural, and I'll throw this out actually because I know there's therapists in the room and you could argue with me because maybe I'm wrong. But I'm increasingly concerned with the idea that particularly in Gen Z, we're seeing this in our singles data and some of our data sets of young people who are dating. About 80% in this new wave of data that we have say that they're they desire forming a romantic relationship. But 45% think that they're not ready to enter a relationship. And I worry sometimes that we're seeing a generation of young people who are kind of leaning in too much to this idea of self-actualizing and isolation, that I kind of have to go work on myself, and I'm going to go work on myself, and work on myself, work on myself, then I can come to the context of dating, and I'll be ready. And you go work on yourself, work on yourself, work on yourself, and you then come, and then we'll be ready. And relationships are a container to make mistakes, to learn, to experience, especially when you have a co-pilot, a partner, when you have that sense of safety, when you have the person who's going to be there when you make a mistake or you're not really sure. So, and that's true for our sexual lives, it's true for our relationship dynamics. So I'm increasingly thinking that there's this combination of too much data that the technology is sort of a piece of, but also what are our expectations when we're dating? What are we showing up to a date and expecting that who we are, who you are, as opposed to kind of the joy of fumbling through.
And you know, and you said, this was actually one of Christy's questions, that just because a relationship ends doesn't mean it failed. What do you mean by that?
Yeah,
I mean,
it sounds
like it's the same, you know.
Yeah. One of the takeaways I have is I think I want to really rethink what relationship success is. And Margaret Mead, I actually took this from Margaret Mead, the famous anthropologist who was at the Museum of Natural History. A journalist asked her once, Dr. Mead, why do you think all three of your marriages failed? And she said, excuse me, all three were a success. And I do think what we have this idea that a relationship should be forever to be successful. And some are. Some, that is the definition. But if we can reimagine, really, what does it mean to be success? So in my work, I'll try a lot to talk about relationship satisfaction, relationship quality. Not a successful or an unsuccessful. You could have a wonderfully successful relationship with someone that you grew about yourself. Maybe you had kids. Maybe you traveled the world. Maybe you focused on your career. But it doesn't necessarily mean it's for life. And I think this idea that till death as the measure of a relationship success, that puts us in a kind of bizarre headspace about what we're expecting of our relationship.
You just got married.
And
your vows, Michelle, did you say till death do us part, or did you skip?
We did. Yeah, we did. Okay. Yeah.
Just checking. And by the way, I will just make a blanket statement. I could be wrong, but I think most of the people in this room probably do not read People magazine on a regular basis. Just throwing that out there. However, this week there was a really beautiful article in People magazine with a picture of Michelle and Justin's wedding. So I encourage you to go online and look that up,
because
they just had a baby, Nico. Okay, but
I will. We do something if I can share. Michelle's been subject to me sharing a lot about our life, and we check in. We check in every so often. We say, are we where we want to be? Is this what you want? Is that something I think a lot about in people's romantic and sexual lives? Is there's sort of three entities. There's me. There's you. And there's us. And we'll check in every so often and say, are we doing what you need? Are we doing what I need? Are we doing what we need as a couple? And I think there are moments that you think, like, all right, we have to realign. It's time for a serious conversation about, you know, where are we? What do we want?
Speaking of sharing,
The
very, very, very first chapter, you talk about how strangers, and I have the same problem. Mm-hmm. It's amazing what strangers will tell you when they find out what kind of work you do. Mm-hmm. But people ask you a lot of questions.
Yeah.
So what is the question that you probably get more than any other question when people find out what you do for a living?
Yeah, and I'm laughing because when they're clinical questions, I go, call Dr. Stryker, this is too much for me.
I bet you could fake it. know a lot.
But we, what are some of the interesting, people will ask a lot, and I think that is also a sense of where do you go, right? So there's folks here where we study sexuality, either as researchers or physicians or therapists, but where do you actually go when you have a question? And do you go to your physician to ask a question about your sexual life? Well, maybe if it's someone with specialty in sexual medicine, your average doc has 1 hour of training, right? Of 30 minutes on male sexual dysfunction and 30 minutes on female sexual dysfunction.
Minutes.
20 minutes, right? So depending on what medical school you're at, depending on your curriculum. Now, we take that for granted, but actually, where do you go when you have a question about your sex life? Your average family therapist isn't particularly equipped. Your average physician isn't particularly equipped. Where do we get curated information? We can find so much about sex online, but where do you get curated, accurate information? So I actually like when people ask questions. I think it's an honor when people, because it's where those of us who are in this field, it's how do we help be a guide? My favorite question, and actually it came out of the book. My editor was like, this is maybe too much, but I could share my favorite. I was on a plane once and I was reading something, and this woman, I was sitting next to a woman. Actually, I was traveling with a colleague and we ran into another colleague. And I was with Amanda Gesselman, who some of you know. And she sat with our other colleague because she says I talk too much when I'm on a plane. And so two of our colleagues sat together and I sat next to this other woman. And I opened something in my bag and she started asking what I did. And I shared what I worked on. And then she started sharing with me this story that she kept ordering us those little bottles of white wine. And and she shared that her and her husband, they sometimes when they were having sex, they would forget to close the door and the cat would come in the room. And sometimes if her husband was on top, the cat would jump on her husband's back and then look over the shoulder and make eye contact with her. And they called it kitty peekaboo sex. And then she asked the question that all of us know is coming, right? And she goes, is that weird? Yeah, is that weird, right? And I thought all of them, yeah. I said, I'll take another white wine, please. And but it is, I think it's the reality of people have quirks in their sexual lives, in their relationship lives. And some are more unusual than others, but I hadn't heard kitty peekaboo sex in another context before.
I have heard a lot. Yeah. I have never heard about kitty peekaboo sex. That's a new one for me. Yeah.
So raise your hand if
someone has told you. You have a lot of people. We've got some therapists here. We've got new people.
There we go.
Yeah, Playboy advisor here.
Yeah.
Did you ever get that question? Yeah. I bet you did. Okay. Right. You in the book, and I'm not going to give it away. Mm-hmm. This was another one that Christy was interested in, and I am as well. What is the primary quality looked for by men and women, young, old, whatever, when they are deciding, I want that person to be my partner? What is the number one thing?
I love this because we see it in study after study. And we often talk about romantic, like a physical attraction. And yes, you want the chemistry, the spark of being attracted to someone. What we found in our study, and we've been tracking this for over 10 years in our Singles in America study, that attraction's important. Actually, attraction isn't even in the top five anymore in the last couple of years. The number one thing both men and women say that they most want in a romantic partner is someone they can trust and confide in. Now, for me, that goes back to the question earlier. That's about connection. That's about intimacy. That's we want partners that we can experience life with. We want partners we can have sex with. But this idea that it sits within this container of someone that we can trust and confide in over and over, both men and women across generations.
You know, I'm going to open up for questions, but there's one last thing I want to say, because there's this book is just so dense and there's so much good stuff, and there's not a page where you don't want to just highlight it and read it to somebody, because there's just so many nuggets throughout. But the one that just really gave me goosebumps when I read it, and I'm not going to tell this because everyone has to buy the book and read it, but this is how you close the book. Mm-hmm. And what you're really talking about is I think a lot of us, we worry about, is there that one person out there for us? Or if you're lucky enough to have found that person and loved that person, and then something happens, and that person is no longer in your life, mm-hmm. and what then? What then? You know, and what you talked about is that you said that we're wired for love, and no matter how perfect that love was, you will find another love. Mm-hmm. It won't be the same. It will be different. And then you told a really lovely story to go with it. So, mm-hmm. I think we all know a lot of people who've been in that situation. And I just, it was just like the perfect button on the book, because it was like, at the end of the day, this is how we are wired. And you just do such an extraordinary job of explaining not only why we're that we are wired, but how that's mm-hmm. happened from an evolutionary point of view. So with that, I am going to open it up to questions. And so normally when I do questions in my world, and I'm like, and if you're shy, you can write them down on a piece of paper, or you could say, I'm asking for a friend. No one in this group is shy, so just blurt it out. And we have a lot of people also in this world who, okay, all right, please.
Would you agree with the statement that maybe our desires in both intimacy and sexuality had a stayed relatively constant, but the borders of acceptabilities have expanded over the years?
And I'm just going to add to that question. I mean, are we really doing things differently now than 100, 200, 300 years ago, or we're just talking about it more, mm-hmm. society? Is it more acceptable?
Yeah, yes and no. And there's partly, when I used to teach the sexuality class, I used to always think, every generation thinks that they're in their own sexual revolution. And in some ways they are. We have these sort of moments of, And I often think when I have college students, I think, well, what do you think your parents and grandparents, like, what did you think happened in the 60s, right? And what do you, and that, to highlight, but that there are moments, that there, now, what I think is interesting is we are in a much more conservative sexual moment than I think we often recognize. So, as an example, at the Kinsey Institute, so we have research laboratories and centers, we have an education program, we have a library and special collection. And outside my colleague Liana's office, who runs our library and collections, there's a poster from a New York City subway in the 1980s, and it's a HIV prevention poster, and it's a cartoon, and it's explicit sexual behaviors you shouldn't do. You would never see that in a subway today. And I think that we can forget that there are moments, we all do, how could we not, that we forget that there are moments that as much as there's a lot of sex in the media right now, is it sex about pleasure? Is it about sexual health? Is it about, what's its role? And I think there's moments, there's examples of stuff that's happening in media right now. So the Heated Rivalry is this great example, right? You're saying this guy's out of his mind. Like, hasn't he watched Heated Rivalry? It's right that sex is everywhere. What's interesting about Heated Rivalry is the folks that are posting the most about it are heterosexual women. So they can't place themselves in the actual, I mean, they can in their mind, but there's a distance between what you're talking about in terms of how you think about what is it that you're watching, that you're representing. And at the same time, then we have Euphoria is getting blasted for having being too sexually gratuitous in its messages, in its episodes. So I think that we're in a moment that culturally we're more sexually conservative than we realize. We also see decreases in sexual frequency, the so-called sex recession. It's actually, what's interesting about the sex recession, it's more zeros. It's more young people who are not having their first sexual event at a younger age. So the average looks lower, but it's actually just more virgins.
Is that intercourse or is that mm-hmm. any sexual contact?
I think from Ad Health data, I think that that's intercourse. Yeah, intercourse. There's less intercourse, but also other kind of sexual behaviors. There's actually an interesting story about that. We can get back to that comment you made. I haven't really answered your question. I'm sorry. So I'm dancing around it. So I think that in some ways, yes, we're more sexually open. We're sort of talking about different behaviors and using toys and using products. And young people in particular are more sexually fluid than past generations. But it depends on our time scale. If we're talking about from 20 years ago, 100 years ago, 2,000 years ago, and if we start looking cross-culturally, there's a lot of variation in what people's sexual lives look like and what their relational lives look like. I'm not particularly sure that we're in a moment that we're more free in our sexual lives. I think that there's a lot happening socially and culturally that we're more restricted. So we had some of the only data, for instance, since Roe v. Wade was overturned, women were waiting longer for sex in a new relationship. So if you had a third date rule about sex, women were pushing it back to 4 dates, 5 dates. So I think there's a lot of pressure on people, more than we sometimes realize, even though we think about sexuality being more flexible than perhaps in recent memory.
I'm laughing because yeah. Bella over yeah. there, Bella Gandhi, who many of you know is the America's dating coach, says, yeah. what, like 12 years until you can have sex or something?
Yeah. 15 dates.
15
12.
Dates.
Yeah. 12 years. We feel like 12 years.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you build a friendship, right? That's the part core of your art. You get to know
somebody slowly. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So this idea that there's evolutionary pressure toward intimacy mm-hmm. and then sex comes next, is that true for both sexes? And here's the data point.
Mm-hmm.
So if we take a lifespan perspective and you look at the search for intimacy and the fact that women have broader social networks mm-hmm. and more intimate relationships, is it equal in that are men looking more for intimacy tied to sex than women are? Data point being later in life when women lose, when they go through divorce,
mm-hmm.
their mortality, they have better health, their cardiovascular system,
yeah.
rate they have. Now, maybe that's just because it's more difficult to be married for female. I don't know what the data are there. Mm-hmm. But do you account for this relationship being the same between the two sexes, or is it more for men than for women because of women's more extensive social thought?
A couple of things, and I'll try to tease them apart, and please pull me back if I stray off tangent, which I tend to do. So I'll start just on that last point about as we age. It's interesting, there have been some studies of, so as we age, men have the difference between male and female mortality. Men die at younger ages than women. So there have been studies of single men, at, like particularly if you start looking after 80. And there have been examples of living in senior communities. It's sort of like a famous example in Florida, but this has been replicated. There's been studies in Europe and in the Netherlands. And so men who are older and they're single, they have often multiple sexual partners and multiple relationships because they have this there's this discrepancy between the available dating market. Now, that's also true of like young people, of where you are, where you're dating, and of any age, what's your market like, what's the availability of partners in a particular place. So there are these sort of age effects that happen for young, depending on the kind of school, particularly like college student samples. Are you in a 50-50 sex segregated school? Are you just heterosexual? Are you looking for sexual events that are experimental? So if you're, for young people in particular, and I mean like Gen Z, we'll see that they experiment in their sexual lives in ways that, let me frame it this way, that we'll ask people, I used to do more work on hookup culture and hookup behavior, and we'll see that people will say, well, I want to date heterosexually, but then I had these things that I did. I hooked up. Because a hookup, a casual encounter, doesn't make them question their own sexual identity in the same way. So you could say, well, we made out on the dance floor, or we just had a one-night stand, but I'm not gay. So this idea that you can kind of play with your sexuality in the absence of the deeper intimacy is a way to sort of test boundaries and experience. I still haven't gotten to your question, but now I'm going to get to it. And so that's sort of one piece of it. On the social relationships, it's sort of interesting. So we know that if we think of what defines social relationships in the broadest sense, particularly if I'm putting on my biological anthropological hat, there's not a species on this planet that kin or is invested in our mating decisions as humans. There's no other species that your family and your closest friends are telling you who you should sleep with and who you should partner with, or really enforcing it in social ways. So that's one type of social network. It's the kin network is really influencing our mating decisions. Now, men, to your point about men and intimacy, there's a lot of evidence that men are more romantic than women on average. So men tend to say, I love you first in a relationship. They tend to have a harder ramp up of limerence of falling romantically in love. They tend to take longer to get over breakups. Men are much more likely to commit suicide after a bad breakup than women. So they have very intense, I would say, biopsychosocial responses to relationships. But they don't necessarily think about it and represent it in the same ways that. So women have these broader networks on average, but there's not that much evidence that that's necessarily playing into our desires for romantic closeness. So we can think of social closeness, that we have friends and people we care about, but there's something unique about romantic and sexual intimacy. That even though we can have friend networks, that we tend to still gravitate towards this desire of someone who knows us in this different way. And one way I've thought about it is we have a desire for social connection, to the point that you're talking about this. We have these desires for social connection and social relationships. We have desires for sexual activity, and we have these attraction systems. Well, a lot of theorists have talked about, so Sternberg talks about the love triangle, Jankowiak talks about a triarchic model, and Alan Fisher talked about three motivational systems. They talk about these three systems of who I'm attracted to, who I'm having sex with, and who I have a friend with, an attachment bond with. And when you can pull them all together, that's the secret sauce that people of everywhere researchers have looked at seem to be looking for. And that there doesn't seem to be a sex difference in the desire for that. I don't know if I fully answered what you're, yeah, thing.
I would love to hear a little bit about your relationship with the book. How's sure. The book change you? What challenged you? Favorite moments in the experience of your journey to this moment?
Yeah, sure. So a book is its own kind of relationship, yeah. Right? In so many ways. And what was interesting, when I started writing the book, I was newly single. I had the biggest data set in the world on singles. So you study the Singles in America study. I was in my 30s. I was using dating apps. I was using three, which is how much the average American uses. So I was very consistent with the data. And I actually started, Michelle and I started dating fairly early in the writing of the book. And it really changed the scope of what I was thinking about as sort of someone being who had just broken up, who was single. I was thinking about these these tensions between love and sex, but then suddenly in this, and then COVID was happening at the same time, and we were negotiating dating in the start of the pandemic. And actually our first date, I didn't write this, our first date, I had just gotten the booster. It just came out, and I was like, I'm so sorry, I have to reschedule. I'm sorry, I couldn't get out of bed from the booster. And I kept thinking, like, she's not gonna, like, we're not gonna reschedule, because most people would say this is a fake story. But she did, thank you. What was interesting about this book is I almost never write about myself, and Christy and Lauren know this, I tend to be pretty private, in part because of what I work on, because I work on sexuality and relationships. And my initial kernel of a story was watching my cousins. My first cousin and I are only children, very close, and her experience with brain cancer and how that influenced her relationship and family, and watching how her and her husband navigated that. And what does it really mean in sickness and in health? And even that, as an evolutionist, actually most species avoid sickness. Even if it's your partner, if they're ill, you kind of get out of dodge. But what is this idea that our bonds are so intense? We don't. We stay through that toughness. That as a biologist, there's a lot to unpack there of why we do that, how we do that. So that was the story that was guiding my thinking. And then I had this own sort of personal story that weaved into the thinking. And then on top of it were all these stories that people tell me, these sort of kiddie peekaboo stories on airplanes. And I realized that, like, how do I make sense of all of that? How do I make sense of so many people are experiencing challenges in their romantic and sexual lives, in the intersection of their romantic and sexual life? And how do I weave that into the science? So it influenced, I think, a lot of my own thinking and my own thinking in my own relationship, but also in my own, because I was in the, and I, some of you will realize I structure the book in the arc of a relationship. So single, searching for a partner, finding a partner, maintaining a partner, having a break with a partner, reforming a bond, finding love again, and sort of situating my own sense in that. And it was funny, actually, before I started writing the book, I am not a big fan of this idea of research, me-search, and we've talked about this. This idea of what's the role of an objective scientist? Do you remember we had a long conversation with a colleague of ours who doesn't think like we do on this? But this idea of that was a good night. So
we only have fun.
Yeah, of like, what's your role as being more objective and more private as opposed to be situating yourself in? And I had. My previous relationship, I was doing a new study on breakups, and my partner at the time once said, like, is there something you want to say? And I was like, no, but this data is really fascinating. But I think there was something I wanted to say that I hadn't quite thought of. So that is its own relationship. And then that weaves into this book more than anything I've ever written, over how my own understanding, because you can understand it on paper, but how do you kind of really embody it? What does that mean? What is that intensity of, I mean, even love, we can think about the science of love. We can think about that there's a pea-sized part of our brain, the ventral tegmental area, that lights up when you're in love with someone. But how does that really relate to the feeling that you get? And
you know, it's so, because it makes it a better book. No, it does, because you always write beautifully, and I love everything you've written, but as I was reading this, and I felt like I was having one of our conversations together, and to allow the world to have that conversation mm-hmm. with you, there's an intimacy in that, mm-hmm. and it really, it makes it work. Makes it work, because it's a lot more than just the research shows this. Mm-hmm. This is how this impacts me and everyone else. So, mm-hmm. Nahama.
Thank you so much for this. And I think what you just said, Lauren, is so apt, you know, that there's all sorts of intimacy. Mm-hmm. And the intimacy between colleagues and your ability to talk about complicated things and include all sorts of data and streams of thought. One funny thought mm-hmm. is, I'm a women's health psychiatrist, uh-huh. but I always am fascinated by how do dogs appeal to each other? Mm-hmm. What are they doing? What's the first thing a dog does when they meet another dog?
They sniff their butt.
Like, that is the last thing that a human, I think, would think of as the way I want to get to know somebody. Mm-hmm. So I was thinking about...
You only make that mistake once.
Yeah. But back 20 years ago, mm-hmm. I was dating a neuroscientist, and there was a lecture in the Mind-Brain Behavior program at Northwestern mm-hmm. on the development of tear ducts by a biologic anthropologist from UC. And I'm like, you know, he said he was going. I thought, well, I'm going to go because, you know, then he'll see that I'm interested in his intellectual phase. It was the most transformative lecture I've ever been to. And she described the absence of tear ducts in mammals until simians, apes, you know, typically sexual encounters were, you know, mounting from behind, until simians began to have face-to-face sex.
But you talked about your
motives was face-to-face. There was such a wellspring of emotion that elicited the development of tears and tear ducts. And it changed my, you know, I mean, it confirmed, of course, everything. That we already know. But it was so exactly what you're talking about, that there are these you know, neurobiological, you know, kind of strata, like deeply rooted strata in our evolution that confirm all of what you're talking about. That's so important and, yeah, complicated.
So thank you.
Thank you.
And there is a lot of that in the book that talks about how that connection, you know, when we became bipedal and we started to do face-to-face encounters.
And not that many primates do. Like gorillas occasionally have been noted to occasionally have face-to-face sex. So this this idea that our whole mating behavior, so I was sort of talking about estrous cycles and menstrual cycles earlier, but there's so much about our anatomy, and there's things about male average male testes size and the shape of the penis and the shape of the glands larger than the shaft. We take this for granted, but there's evolutionary stories about our genitals, about our bodies, about where even how we think about notions of erogenous zones and how that varies by cultures, different cultures. In between, we talk about the Kinsey reports as an interesting example, the 1948 sexual behavior of the human male, 1953 sexual behavior of the human female. In between, there was a book called Patterns of Sexual Behavior by Ford and Beach. Frank Beach was the sort of father of modern behavioral endocrinology. And in that, they take a more anthropological example, and I think they said, and if I'm remembering correctly, I could be wrong, it's being recorded, so I hate to say the numbers, but I think it's 13 out of 188 societies they looked at sexualized the breast. So we take for granted that we sexualize breasts, that that's part of, and there's all these theories about how it's part of human evolution, and is it like the rump of a female primate, and it's like most places in the world don't do this, right? What happens when we actually look at the evidence? That that there's these sort of complicated nuances about what happens in different places of the world and what happens when we think of our biology. I love the tear ducts one because there's also some evidence that we can smell tear ducts. So particularly when babies are crying, that we have there's a smell. And that part, I mean, part of the issue of, I think, dating apps and technology today is it's so divorced from our evolutionary legacy of you hear someone's voice, you see their body language, you know their social network, you can touch them, you can feel them, you can hear them, you can smell them, you can taste them, that we invoke the bodily senses. So it's not necessarily to say it's good or bad, but it is to say we're in totally uncharted territory as a species of how we think about how we're connecting in terms of mechanisms that we had refined over 4 million years. So
will there be a TV series?
We're going to do it? Let's do it.
We're gonna turn this public conversation into some one-on-one, because I know that Justin needs to sign some books and you have to help me eat food so that I don't have to put it away. And then on the way out, there's a little bowl there and I want you all to grab some lube and a vulva sticker, because that's how we roll here at the Rush Rider House.
And the slideshow.
Oh, and then if you haven't made your way around to the TV room, playing on the screen is the Kinsey Art Collection. It is extraordinary. It is second to the Vatican as far as the world's largest collection of erotica. So please take a look at that. And
not confirmed, but that's our running joke. Yeah.
Well, you know, I believe it. I believe it. But so let's just continue the conversation.
Thank you. Thank you.